Feel like we're right about on time. How's everybody doing today? Very good. My name is Tony Briscoe. I'm the Air Quality and Environmental Health Reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and I'll be your MC this morning. I really appreciate you all for joining us today for what I feel like will be a really robust discussion on one of the more underappreciated aspects of wildfire coverage, which is the kind of insidious effects of wildfire smoke. I feel like we've all heard, the phrase, where there's smoke, there's fire. Well, we're going to be looking at things a little bit in the inverse. Just because, I feel like with the headlines that, we've seen in recent years, we've had a lot of, coverage surrounding wildfires. And, and that's been warranted with the historic numbers of acres that we've seen burned. Solely looking at California, we've had a historic amount of acreage that's burned in 2020. We had the deadliest wildfire season on record in 2018. But what's often lost, I feel like, is, the hidden health impacts from the exposure to the soot, the ash, the air contaminants that we're breathing in. And often these natural disasters are lasting for months. So to discuss this more in length, we have an awesome panel here today joining us, and I'm going to turn it over to them for brief introductions and to discuss this more about their work. So, Camille, would you like to start?
Yeah, for sure. My name is Camille Fassett. I'm a data reporter on AP's climate and environment team. I've done a fair amount of wildfire coverage. I covered the CZU complex fires in Santa Cruz, California, pretty extensively in 2020. I've also done a lot of work on outages and looking at utilities, the effects of wildfires on utilities, and did a lot of air quality related coverage in 2020 and 2021. So I'm based in Seattle.
I'm Phoebe Seaton. I'm not a journalist. I'm with an advocacy organization called Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. We're based in the San Joaquin Valley of California and the Coachella Valleys, which are two of the three major agricultural regions of the state. And we work on broadly on environmental issues. And so wildfire shows up once a year, for many months, as part of those issues, and look forward to talking more.
I'm John. I run the journalism program at Climate Central, which is a very unusual nonprofit group that employs scientists, meteorologists, data analysts, journalists, and we all collaborate internally. And so I'm collaborating with my colleagues to get data that was going through the organization. We're also collaborating with academic scientists to get data. And my role at Climate Central, I'm taking that data and I'm using that to inform local stories around the country, which we produce exclusively through collaborations with local outlets. So we contribute the science reporting, the data reporting, the expertise, and the local outlets are doing all of the local reporting. They know their communities. So it's a nice way for us to do journalism. I'm based in New Jersey now, which does have wildfire issues, but my interest in wildfires goes back. I grew up in Australia, studied geography and ecology there, and then I cut my teeth as a reporter in California, and I was there for quite some time. So although I'm in New Jersey now, which doesn't have as many fires as the West, it's something that's been of interest to me for a long time.
And certainly covered, wildfires in the Great Plains. So certainly, even though, the West has seen some of the most acute effects, it's certainly a national issue as well that we'll be discussing. So, Phoebe, I wanted to start with you just in terms of, what we've seen. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley in California has been among the most affected communities from wildfires and wildfire smokes. I wanted to see if you could tell us a little bit about what you've seen on the ground, and I guess could you describe for us, some of the most vulnerable populations that are affected by this?
Sure, and maybe noted this in the beginning that wildfire is one of many. It's not wildfire, it's this or it's that. It's so that in terms of climate and environmental impacts, we have often we work a lot on extreme heat. And the link between extreme heat, climate change, and wildfire, and then now floods is a really, really big issue. If it's not wildfire, if it's not floods, it's drought and depletion of water. Sometimes now we are still having depletion of water and floods, and looking out to not feeling safe from wildfires coming up. So, the San Joaquin Valley is a valley, and the fire from the probably all regions of the state often come and settle in the region, as Tony was mentioning. And what we see is people are not safe at work is a really acute issue. So a lot of outdoor work, a lot of agricultural work, and there's some protections. Over 500 AQI, people are not supposed to work outside. Over 150 AQI, people are supposed to be given masks. And I think over 500 AQI, if there is work outside, it's mandated. This is all, you know, heavily kind of a system reliant on reporting. And if it's not happening at the workplace, workplace reporting, which is really, really hard for folks who are dependent on their work for their rent and their food, et cetera. So what we see is a lot of lack of compliance. And then some of us have issues with just even requiring people to work in conditions like that. And why don't we have systems in place to protect workers? And the kind of on the other side, beginning of the day, end of the day, but a lot of people in housing that isn't set up to protect people from the elements, from the outdoors, from wildfire. So we see just a lot of people living 24 hours a day really impacted by wildfire.
Camille and John, I wanted to turn to you all because certainly in recent years, we've gotten a lot more data. We've gotten a lot more tools that could assist our reporting. I guess, were you all, you know, looking for, I guess, helpful tools and data? You know, and how has reporting on the whole kind of evolved over the years when it comes to the effects of wildfire smoke?
Yeah, I've, you know, my interest in climate change has always been that there's so many different factors at play, and certainly when it comes to wildfires, that's the same. And we at Climate Central, we did our first smoke projects in 2016, 2017. And at that time, I think that a lot of reporting on smoke was more, oh, it's a nuisance. But also at that time, you know, epidemiologists, scientists were trying to sound alarms. They were trying to do a lot of research, but also sound alarms about the fact that this is a really nasty pollutant. Fire, if you burn wood, you get really nasty pollution with, you know, really nasty and often underestimated health effects, whether that's for burning biomass for energy or whether it's from wildfires. And at that time, we were really struggling. At Climate Central, we try to be at the tippy point. We're always trying to push the issues that are emerging. And we were trying to figure out how to, and all of our work really relies on data, and we're trying to figure out how to cover wildfire smoke when there was so little data. It was just from a few EPA monitoring stations and whatnot. But since then, there's a lot more data available now, and we'll hear about that soon. But we have, from remote sensing, combined with calibrations with ground sensors. There's a lot of really good data coming out of places like Stanford, AP. So there's a lot more opportunities now to figure out where the smoke is, where it's going, where is being the heaviest hit. Places like the Valley, you know, San Joaquin Valley, typically vulnerable areas with large populations of very vulnerable communities, because these are the places where other people didn't want to live. And so nowadays, I think we're seeing a lot of really nuanced and thoughtful coverage of wildfire smoke, its health effects, and its connection to both climate change, but also legacy land mismanagement type issues. So, yeah, I think that as a whole, environmental and health journalists are doing a really good job of trying to aggressively run this down. So too are a lot of scientists in aggressively trying to understand the health effects, who is most vulnerable, but also creating these data sets that allow you to see where the smoke is concentrating most heavily, hopefully soon in real time, but certainly you can look back now about 20 years and find that data.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us, I mean, it seems like there is an abundance now of data, of, you know, what was mentioned already, just the air quality index, which is kind of the rainbow wheel of looking at the different factors that would affect and really kind of makes it pretty presentable in terms of what's hazardous and not. But I guess, where are you looking in terms of, like, data sets? And you certainly have done some analysis. I mean, can you walk us through the analysis that you did on that and how you kind of weeded through all the different data that's out there?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I guess to kind of start off, I think there's consensus at this point that wildfires are worse than they used to be, but I think it's really difficult to sort of quantify that and just sort of like how are they worse and what metrics actually matter for establishing wildfire severity, I think is actually a pretty challenging problem. Like, I think the kind of instinct is to look at things like acres burned, which isn't always the best metric, you know, as we know now, especially given, you know, the history of fire suppression. Sometimes there can be kind of like, you know, kind of long-term, low-intensity burns. So, you know, that might not be the best metric. There's all these different metrics that we can look at to evaluate the severity of wildfires. And I think a big data and reporting challenge is being able to synthesize all of those different metrics together and communicate to the public what it means and how we know that wildfires are getting worse. When it comes to, I mean, I think that the health effects are the really obvious, one really obvious way in which the wildfire seasons are getting a lot more severe. And yeah, you know, I haven't been a reporter for super long, so I don't know that I can speak to, like, you know, how wildfire and specifically the health effects of wildfires worked, you know, years ago. But I think that there's a pretty rich data environment available. Definitely, I have leaned pretty heavily on, like, the EPA has like, an air quality index API, which is an API is application programming index if you're a data person. But, you know, you can also just download a spreadsheet if that's easier, too. We use that instead of things like PurpleAir, just since there's a lot of variance with tools like PurpleAir. So one thing that I did, I did a story looking at the amount of people in different counties that had been exposed to hazardous air pollution, not just unhealthy, but looking at kind of the most extreme exposure to air pollution. We ended up settling on a metric that I guess we'd call people days, which is a kind of a complicated metric to kind of explain. But basically what that means is looking at the total population or the number of people times the number of days that they experienced hazardous air quality. So it's kind of looking at individual level exposures to really hazardous air quality. So we did a story looking at the counties across the West for the 2020 wildfire season. So for that, I pulled the EPA's air quality API and kind of did an aggregated analysis looking at county populations. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty extreme. The visuals were pretty striking, just, you know, the number of people that have experienced you know, weeks of hazardous air pollution is unprecedented looking back towards when the data was first collected. So I think that's a really great data resource. The other one that people use a lot on health and wildfires is looking at the CDC's ER visits, looking at respiratory related ER visits during wildfire seasons. You can usually see like a pretty significant spike around like asthma and respiratory related ER visits. So that's one thing to mention.
John, you mentioned remote sensing, which is kind of, you know, a great tool to kind of see how widespread these issues are. And certainly in recent years, we've seen these transcontinental, you know, plumes of smoke, things, you know, smoke going from California all the way to Boston, you know, things like that. How do you kind of take that information? What are you using to kind of track that and also gauge kind of the health impacts, I guess, across where these plumes of smoke are traveling?
So Climate Central is not doing this analysis. We're relying on our relationships, our collaborations with academic scientists. But basically the remote sensing is basically satellites are flying over Earth, and they have been doing so for decades. And so you can see where the smoke is, but that doesn't necessarily tell you where how high it is. You know, if it's 100 feet in the sky, it doesn't matter. So there's lots of really good data sets that are coming out showing that help with mapping, and there's already modeling that is you know, very useful in showing where the smoke is going to be. And we do see, obviously, places close to fires, valleys are heavily impacted in California. But we do, even in New Jersey, New York, you know, up in Boston, we get these remarkable sunsets sometimes a few days after the Western wildfires begin. And it's hazy and the air quality is bad. And I used to be a little bit dismissive of the impacts of this on the East Coast, given it's so severe on the West Coast. It's like, come on. But there's research out now that shows that the effects of this smoke on mortality, on public health on the East Coast, is actually potentially worse overall than it is in the West. And the explanation for that is that it's the population density. There's just so many people living in that corridor. Yeah, I think that this will be the first year that we start actually trying to collaborate and produce some stories about the health effects of wildfires as far east as the East Coast. But I would also say that fires are a big part of the West, but they're also a part of the Southeast, and to a lesser extent, they can be a part of the Northeast. And we've got data coming out in about a month that was produced in-house. It's very difficult to tease out the different causes of wildfires. Some of it's climate change, and then there's also the overgrowth in the forests. But what we've seen in the data, and I'm about to start setting up some of our collaborations, so we haven't investigated it very closely yet, but the shoulder season, spring and fall, on the East Coast, particularly in the Southeast, we are starting to see some real increases in the number. It's the number of fire weather days each year. That's what we're looking at. These are the days when small blazes become big ones. These are the days when emergency responders are extremely strained. And so I think that, unfortunately, the East, especially the Northeast, is very naive when it comes to fires. So we've just had a huge blaze in New Jersey in the Pine Barrens that sent smoke everywhere. So right now we do have a big issue with smoke wafting from California. And again, I apologize. I feel like it's so ridiculous. You guys are living with it. But we do have a big issue with the smoke moving from the West Coast, wherever it's burning, the West, to the East. But we are starting to see some pretty big fires on the East Coast. I think we're going to see more and more, is what the data is suggesting. But it's also difficult because you need to have prescribed burns to get the fuel off the forest floor. And the more of these hot, dry, windy days you have, the more difficult it is. So I think that East Coast reporters, Midwest reporters, there's really good stories for you to tell when it comes to the health effects of this smoke. And moving forward, when it comes to wildfire risks and hazards, this is something that communities are going to have to start dealing with that haven't really thought about it previously.
You know, Phoebe, I wanted to ask you, an organization, that is working hand in hand with the community, I guess, how do communities typically respond to, the smoke exposure? Do they generally try and kind of stick it out, or do you see a lot of migration just given, the impacts, or I guess, what's your sense of how folks typically respond?
You know, our experience is people generally stay. A lot of people stay because, I'm staying, this is my home, this is where I'm going to stay. And a lot of people stay because they're tied to work in the area. And a lot of people stay because there isn't anywhere else to go. Some people, one of the things that we're working on really intensively right now is developing what we call in California community resilience centers that would at least be a place for people to go 365 days a year for a variety of issues, but in times of crisis, extreme heat, extreme cold, wildfire, a place with safe air, clean air, safe temperatures, et cetera, so that there's at least a respite or a refuge for the most severe days and the most severe times. And there just isn't, maybe a tangential to your point, there right now isn't any kind of safety net network for people to turn for people to go to in times of wildfire. Sometimes in times of fire, in times of we just had flooding, there's at least, evacuations to centers, et cetera. Again, totally not adequate. But in times of wildfire, there's nothing like that. Trying to build as close to people as possible, the places and the resources that they need.
I know that this is something that, has impacted you personally when you were living in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I guess, can you walk us through, the 2020 wildfire season, what that was like being from a community that was impacted by this and how that kind of informed your reporting? Did you do things a little bit differently, given that you were reporting on your own community, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that my experience is less and less unusual for people living in the West, but what happened was that in August of 2020, I was living in Boulder Creek, which is a really magical little mountain town, if anyone's familiar, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and we were renting. It was great, especially during COVID, and, there were a lot of fires burning nearby, and eventually we got an evacuation order from the CZU complex fires, and we were not there at the time and that we got the evacuation order. It happened very, very suddenly, and we were trying to rush home because we have cats, and we were really worried that we were, not going to be able to get our cats. And by the time we got there, there was a road closure, and we had to basically, beg the police to let us through to get our cats, and it was honestly pretty traumatic. And We ended up going to stay with some family in the Bay Area, and we were there for about a month and a half. And during that time, we had no idea whether the house, you know, was there. We were in, like, a Facebook group with a bunch of our neighbors who were, you know, like, a few of them actually cut fences to go into the neighborhood, even though the roads were all blocked, to kind of get a sense of what was going on with their homes, and were actually defending the houses from the fires themselves, because CAL FIRE did not have the capacity to actually defend a lot of the structures, and they had actually made a pretty intentional decision to, like, not in a lot of those neighborhoods. So, I mean, that was really wild. It was certainly, like, a look at wildfires that I had not experienced prior. I'm also not, like, that kind of reporter, usually. I'm a data reporter, so I work on the technical side of things. So I ended up actually, you know, having a solo byline at AP, which is pretty unusual at AP, especially for a data reporter. And that was because I was covering basically that community's efforts to fight the fires themselves. And that was, I don't know that I would have even found out that was happening if it hadn't affected me so personally. I mean, the house that we were renting, there's a guy named Mike, who I didn't know prior to this all happening, who lived in the neighborhood. And the house that we were renting survived solely because of this guy named Mike, who was like, hey, by the way, you know, the logs in front of your house caught fire again. I put them out. Here's a photo. And we were just like, thanks, Mike. And, you know, when we were finally able to go back to the house, you know, like, I mean, it was wild, you know, all the trash cans were totally melted, the gutters were all melted, but, you know, all of our stuff was okay, and that wasn't the case for a lot of the neighborhood, but it was just, I mean, and we were just renters, obviously, we didn't own the house, but the fact that all of our stuff survived was solely due to this guy named Mike, and that was just, like, really wild. I think people were willing to talk to me in a way that they might not have been otherwise because I was affected. You know, I mean, I was an evacuee myself. I think it was pretty healing for me, too, to be talking to people who were in a pretty similar situation. I very much understood, like, all of the unknowns of, like, when would we be able to go back? Like, not having any idea if your house, you know, survived. There, like, it's a pretty rural community. A lot of people have, like, farm dogs and goats, and a lot of those people weren't able to get those animals out. So there was another guy named Keith who had decided to go in and try to get all of these animals out pretty much on his own. So we were trying to support, you know, him any way that we could. And, you know, I think the idea of objectivity in journalism is maybe not something that very many people buy into anymore. And I guess, you know, I would agree. I think that there's a level of, I think as reporters, it's important to be able to kind of see what we're doing as, yeah, a service to these specific people in this specific community. And I think it really speaks to, the importance of communities being covered by their own communities and the importance of local journalism. And that wasn't something that I had, yeah, quite as personal of an experience of before.
And I feel like it's a little bit more tricky, too, just when it comes to, like, smoke exposure versus, like, the, you know, property damage that we're usually used to, you know, looking at when it comes to fires. Usually you can kind of see with the maps that different fire authorities kind of put out, this is where it's affected. You can kind of reverse look that up to see, you know, where that property, you know, destruction has occurred to get folks. But I guess, is it trickier, have you all found, to find folks who are impacted, you know, with the health impacts from smoke exposure? You guys really found some great, you know, sources who were impacted with different respiratory conditions. I guess, how did you find those folks who were impacted the most by this?
Yeah, so, you know, we work with our local partners to find the anecdotes and the characters. And, you know, just like any type of reporting, any type of environmental reporting, just going into the neighborhood and talking to people is very fruitful. And people are eager to talk about the smoke problem. Other ways that you can find good sources are the local doctors and local nurses. The American Lung Association is very good. They've got a network of like asthma doctors around the country who are very good at talking to the media. They're great sources. They will often be able to also introduce you to some of their more severely affected patients, people with lung asthma, for example. So, and then you really want to be focusing on the vulnerable communities, and these are frequently, you know, frontline communities, black and brown communities, but also thinking about seniors, thinking about young children, and, you know, if when the school closes and the kids have to stay home, what if their house is no more safer than the school? So I think that finding characters is, of course, integral to any reporting on health, and that certainly is the case for smoke coverage. And you shouldn't have too much difficulty finding people who are willing to talk. But what I would say is just keep in the back of your mind, be asking about the kids, be asking about the asthmatics, be asking about the seniors, because they're the ones who face the gravest risks. And there's also economic impacts when people can't go to work, particularly, you know, low-wage workers, outdoor workers. They're either having to go out there and work in the smoke, or the operations are being shut down and they have to stay home. So work with some of the groups that represent farm workers. They're fantastic sources as well. But yeah, I think it's just it's become pretty straightforward, I think, to just do the normal stuff. Talk to the doctors. Try to talk to nurses. The nurses are the ones who have a better understanding of how people's lives are affected by whatever it is they're dealing with. The doctors are very good at talking about the health effects, but then it's the nurses who really understand what it means when somebody has bad asthma and it means that they can't leave their house for a week. So, yeah, I think it's and also the data set that I've been talking about, you know, you can find it through Stanford. We hope to incorporate it into some of our tools at some point this year. But you can use that to really hone in and see which areas get hit the hardest and the most frequently by these smoke waves, and then geographically targeting your reporting in those areas.
I think everything you said is totally spot on. I guess just personally, I utilize social media pretty hard in terms of finding people affected by fires. You know, this isn't really scalable, but in my case, Nextdoor was super useful. I mean, I was in the Nextdoor instance of you know, that neighborhood. But I used Facebook and Reddit quite a lot. I mean, these communities come together pretty quickly to share information about these kind of things. So I think, and I think in my case in particular, because I was someone that had been affected, it was pretty easy to be like, hey, you know, like, I'm a reporter, I'm an evacuee too, you know, looking to speak to people. And, you know, there were tons of people who were really eager to speak to me. So we found a number of elders and children who had been directly affected. So yeah, that was actually pretty straightforward.
John, you spoke to this a little bit earlier, but I guess it really is a complex equation, I guess, when you're talking about wildfires and the reasons that these natural disasters are breaking out, because, you know, there is so much involved, whether it's, you know, climate change, the, you know, way that things are getting drier, warmer, you know, land management obviously being a big thing, and then obviously human just interaction just out there. I guess, how do you tease out, you know, how much we can attribute to climate change versus historic suppression, all of that?
Yeah, no, it's really difficult. It's something that, you know, anytime you're talking about the role that climate change plays in any kind of a disaster, it's very difficult. With wildfires, it's wickedly difficult. So you can't have a story that talks about... So many stories about a wildfire will say... We'll really focus on, okay, who started this? Was it a campfire? Who's the bad guy? Who started it? But really, why did the conditions exist that allowed it to become such a huge blaze? And that's where we look at, you know, a century of wildfire suppression, an underutilization of indigenous land management practices, prescribed burning. Forest thinning, occasionally mechanical forest thinning can be useful in some contexts. But so you need to talk about the fact that there's a lot more fuel on the ground, and you also have to talk about the fact that climate change is making conditions much more conducive to wildfire spreading. As you mentioned, there's also the spark. Where did the spark come from? As rising housing costs push more people into the edge of the forest, the wooey, there's more opportunities for fires to start there. And once you have all these homes there, it becomes much harder for the agencies to manage fires because they're focusing on protecting the homes. And so it's very difficult. And what you need, and if you talk to a climate modeler, they're going to tell you that all of this wildfire activity is because of the changing climate, because they're looking at their data and, wow, a strong signal. When you talk to the people who spend their time on the ground, the foresters, the land managers, they're more likely to emphasize the overgrown forest because that's what they're seeing. So we have these two huge crises, these two huge factors colliding, and collectively they're producing these wildfires. So when you talk about the causes, it helps be very nuanced. We've been trying to, we came across a really one of my colleagues, She's our analyst in Sacramento. A couple of years ago, we started putting out analyses throughout the West of the number of days each year when there's fire weather. So it's hot, it's dry, and it's windy. And we, looking back, so she reconstructed all this from the data, the sensors that are out there. And I think that we've had a lot of success. I really like this approach. These are the days when the fires get out of control. So looking at the role of climate change in increasing the number of days when you have wildfire weather, that's really useful. We found great success with that. As I say, we're about to put out our analysis looking at the rest of the country. So you need to be careful and thoughtful in your reporting and make sure you're talking to climate scientists and land managers. But overall, the one thing I've really come to like is using these wildfire weather days. That is a function of climate change. It's also a function, let's not forget, California has this wildly variable climate anyway, you know. So when we're looking back 20, 30 years, maybe we're seeing a climate change signal. We're definitely seeing a climate change signal, but we're also seeing a lot of this variability that's just natural to California. So it just helps to be really thoughtful and to do that extra bit of reporting. Just, you know, talking to two different types of experts can really help. You know, I can tell from a headline who the reporter talked, what type of scientist the reporter talked to. Sure. So you want to just take the extra time to do that extra science reporting. Different disciplines will tell you different things, and everything that they're saying is valid, even though it seems that they're coming up against one another.
Phoebe, I wanted to say, I mean, you can't talk about this without talking about, you know, the solutions that need to happen. I guess, you know, from, you know, government agencies that are involved, private land managers, you know, I guess what needs to happen to mitigate the effects of, you know, smoke exposure and wildfires?
Well, and I think everybody on this panel is more of an expert on wildfire than I am, and then there's a whole world of, I'll talk about two things, one on the solutions and mitigation side, which I hit on, and then one on the relationship with journalists and identifying solutions. So one is, you know, we talked about making sure that people have access to a refuge, a place to be, a place that's safe, and investing in that infrastructure. And as I'm an advocate and an organizer, still think of myself as an organizer, but is just even having those safe places is so incredibly critical for social cohesion and bring communities together. So it's has long-term benefits, short-term benefits. And so, like, kind of looking at that, like, what safety infrastructure needs to be in place, making homes safe. And I think I was telling two of you that recently we worked on $1 million grant to just get air filtration into homes, which doesn't really strike a passion chord for me because I'm like, no, we should be fixing the problem, but it's definitely going to fix the problem for hundreds and hundreds of families or make the problem better for hundreds of families who are going to get that air filtration systems into their homes. And then I think another issue is that we kind of as advocates, but also the community members that we're working with often get asked, all right, there's all of this extra fuel in the forest, but you're also against us coming to the San Joaquin Valley and burning it in the biomass facilities. Yeah. Choose one. And so there's, I think, a lot of pressure on kind of community-based advocates, community-based organizations, but also, like, you know, people who are living with the impacts of wildfire to say, okay, how do we manage land better so that you're not in this situation? And it often feels like the same people are bearing the burden of both the impacts and then having to change 100 years of land management and fuel production and gas and oil extraction that's caused climate change. That often feels, definitely a little bit kind of unfair, but then, and I might talk about this a little bit later, but just the relationship between the community members who are impacted and journalists. So I have to do a lot more on climate change, have to do a lot more on land management. But in the meantime, really investing in those mitigation strategies is critical.
Is there anything that, you know, you would like to see more from journalists as far as coverage or things that we could do better, in your experience?
Yeah, and, you know, one of the this is, again, there's an issue, this wildfire, and there's a community. Let's even say there's a crew of farm workers. where the boss, you know, isn't providing the protective gear that's necessary or putting people out in a really dangerous situation. I think we as advocates are like, if this gets into the LA Times, this is going to be huge. You know, this could really drive policy change. From a journalist's perspective, it's like, you know, I don't want to speak for y'all, but this could be huge. This could change policy and protect people. But often from a community member's perspective, like, I'm putting my family at risk by going on the record, or I might lose my job for this year, or I just might create more drama in my life when right now I just really, really, really need to focus on getting to tomorrow. And so I don't have quite a solution for this, but just having a little bit of, kind of grace and understanding that not, and this goes for us too, is that not everybody is kind of on the same page of the solution to your problem is getting this into the, the Sunday morning paper. And a couple things that have helped a lot recently is more openness to anonymity when somebody's jobs are at risk or somebody feels at risk. We do a lot of work in the related to the dairy industry, and there's a lot of retaliation in that context. So that I think is one, and then two, just kind of being flexible to meeting, like, literally meeting people where they are and going to places where people are, where communities are, and listening. I think kind of being acknowledging the power differential, and this again, I'm talking a lot about the people that we work with, the power differential between like us and the community members, but also journalists and the community members. Recently we had a situation where somebody wanted to show how contaminated water was, so they wanted to show a woman bathing her child, but they didn't get the shot that they want, so they came back the next day and said, I want you to bathe your child again. And she's like, but I don't have heat right now and it's cold. And he's like, no, it'll just be really quick. Yeah, I think from his perspective, it was like, this will be great for you. And from her perspective, she was like, he says it's going to be great for me, so I'll do this. So just kind of being, kind of keeping that in mind.
It's always important, I feel like, to talk about sensitivity when it comes to, disadvantaged communities and marginalized communities. So certainly. Another thing that I feel like is a bit overlooked, especially for, I just joined the LA Times about a year ago, and wildfires were really new for me, and I guess I didn't realize how they would impact me or how to protect myself when I went in. I guess, do you all have any safety tips just for folks who maybe aren't familiar with covering this on the ground and kind of going through that, just protecting yourself?
One point, there's another session happening right at the same time about indoor air quality. I don't think these things are entirely separate. There's a lot of, and I think people care a lot more about that kind of thing than they used to. So I think people are pretty worried about, wondering how to protect themselves. I mean, yeah, I guess your question was about how journalists protect themselves too. But yeah, I mean, fine. I think, yeah, it's all related. Not all masks are created equal, as we learned, during COVID in particular. And I think wearing, P100 is obviously, even better, or N95s if not. It's pretty challenging because, a lot of people during wildfire season aren't privileged enough to live in a home with good insulation. So even if you're running a bunch of air filters, if you live in an old house that's got, air drafting through it, it's pretty hard to really mitigate against that. I mean, certainly if you're out reporting in the community, I would wear a good respirator. Although I guess I didn't have to do this as much since, most of the interviewing that I did was virtual. But now that I think about it, I guess it seems pretty challenging to try to interview someone wearing a P100 respirator. It's pretty hard to actually enunciate. Mm-hmm. So, I'm curious how other people have managed that in the past. But yeah, when we were, going through the month, 6 weeks basically of hazardous smoke in California in 2020, I mean, we pretty much wore N95s. The house did not have insulation, so we wear it just all day. It was super uncomfortable. But I know that there's also one of the mini tours is about wildfire safety training too. So I'm sure that'll be great. Yeah. You have thoughts?
I don't have much to add. I do see a strong element of machismo when it comes to the photographers who go into the fires not wearing masks. It also exists in a lot of the wildland. Firefighters can be reluctant to use any kind of protective gear. And hopefully, if folks went out to the national NFIC, the national whatever that interagency thing is, they're doing a lot of work to try to think about how they can better protect wildland firefighters. But for me, unfortunately, there's a lot of reporting during a disaster. I've always specialized in reporting after the disaster. So there's a lot of TV crews that go in and report during a hurricane. You know, they have the weatherman stand out in the... Oh, look how windy it is. But I've always found that the more fruitful, meaningful reporting comes after, when you can talk to people, you can look at the recovery, you can look at who was affected. That doesn't really work during a smoke wave, though. I would say that I have been out in smoke waves to do reporting. I found it extremely difficult. Use Zoom as much as you can. Phone it in. Just try to minimize your exposure to that smoke. And let the breaking news guys, do whatever they do to go in disasters and stay safe. And really, you're going to find your more interesting, your more fruitful stories in the days and weeks after.
Oh, absolutely. This is a little bit, I feel like, trickier, but I feel like it really bears, mentioning, which is, how do you kind of decipher the impacts of wildfire emissions, as far as climate is concerned? Obviously, this is, wildfires are a natural part of the system. They have been for, millennia. But I guess, we have a lot less wiggle room now when it comes to emissions. How can we kind of decipher how much of an impact we can have, especially as we're trying to scale up in states like California and elsewhere, just our prescribed burning? Is there a place that we could find emissions?
I can talk to that quickly, if that's right. Yeah, so you can actually find data. Certainly the Europeans, their satellite missions are out there producing estimates of the carbon emissions from each fire. But I would advise caution on that. There was a really good session yesterday that was talking about the fact that we've been overestimating the emissions from wildfires, because a lot of the carbon tends to remain in the soil. Remains in the stumps, in the dead trees. Mm-hmm. So it can be it's a tricky topic.
Yeah.
I think that states they have a motivation to calculate. California has a motivation to try to calculate its emissions from wildfires. But I think as far as journalists are concerned, I think emissions from wildfires, I would not focus so much on the climate angle. I would focus more on the public health angle. Mm. But if you do want to go down that road,
sure.
There is data available. And there's just I would say immerse yourself in the most recent science on this. And it's moving. It's not an easy thing to get out of science right now. Does that sound right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'd be happy to talk to you more.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
Well, we want to turn it over to you all to ask some questions and do Q&A. I will give you the pre-speech that I'm sure you all have heard many times and time again. We're going to prioritize SEJ members and journalists first. Also, just in the interest of time, we're just going to try and keep it as succinct as possible, so no speeches, life stories, anything like that, y'all. Yes?
So I'm Devin Parmelo, and I'm the graduate assistant at the Center for Environmental Journalism. And I think that through this panel, I would like to hear from all of you guys on this. But with the increase, or there's new science out that says that as wildfire smoke blows over metropolitan areas in the West, it's creating more ozone. And I think it is a really interesting factor that we have now, and I'm interested in the long-term reporting and also the human impacts that this could have in the long term, and the kind of what your guys' take is on how this is impacting communities for months and months afterwards, and especially with continued wildfire happening all the time, which is just adding that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I guess I'll start. You all should add on. I mean, that's a really great point. I think that I think that's a point that, you know, and you all brought up earlier as well, is that, like, you know, so there's a lot of coverage, right, in that kind of immediate, this wildfire is happening, but then this sort of this, like, long-term, like, what are the long-term effects on these communities is, I think, something that's definitely harder to do, and is not specific to wildfires, but just sort of a problem in journalism generally, right? But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is that we really don't know, like, the long-term health impacts of kind of, like, chronic, really, really hazardous wildfire smoke. I think a lot of that is really, really unknown. There's a lot of other kind of like long-term chronic health conditions that are like correlated with, you know, like exposure to that kind of air quality. But I think for a lot of this, you know, there just hasn't been enough time to kind of like see those population level changes. But yeah, I think like talking to physicians about those kind of things. Yeah, I guess I'm curious, like, what, I'm sure there's like a number of academics that are maybe doing like some like maybe medium long-term studies looking at communities that are affected. I think that could be like one interesting route, but I would love to do more on that. I think that's a great point.
Yeah, there is research. There's researchers who are looking. Ozone is a hell of a complicated subject, as we probably all know, because we all cover environmental issues. How do wildfires contribute to ozone? It's not easy to figure out where, but we do know that they are producing more ozone, and we also know that increasing temperatures are producing more ozone. So we are seeing more ozone in our cities as a result of climate change. The different roles that fire and exhaust emissions play, I think, is very, you'll have a lot of difficulty finding the latest answers on that. But certainly we know that it has the effect of increasing ozone. We know that ozone tortures our lungs, so you can confidently report that there's that relationship, but when it comes to the nuance and the details, it's still pretty tricky.
Yeah, I don't have that much to add. It just did trigger that, just the overlapping and figuring out how to pull out the ozone increases from X as compared to Y as compared to, I think we're learning more about just generally volatile organic compounds. And one of the things that we had a pre-call. So when I'm just remembering some of that, one of the things that we talked about too is that, like, in, at least in the San Joaquin Valley, in the time, in wildfire time is also harvest season. So you're also getting like massive, massive emissions from lots of things that happen during the harvest. And then as soon as the air quality gets good enough to have agricultural burns, you have those. So it does seem like a big task, and I'm glad all of you are on it to decipher what is from what and how to address that.
Yeah, and don't forget, it's not just PM 2.5. You know, when a wildfire burns, it's not just burning wood, it's burning tires, it's burning plastic, it's burning everything. So really nasty cocktails of air pollution.
Whether you start out by perhaps getting tipped off by a researcher or a community advocate, if there's a trend that you want to go see, whether it's reflecting the data, whether you're going into the data first, looking for trends and reporting out stories based on that.
Definitely the latter for the most part on wildfires specifically, to be honest. Like, a lot of that, the data that's available is like, I mean, you're kind of going to be looking at the same thing for every fire. Like, I would love to really expand the kinds of data that we specifically on like health impacts that we look at. But yeah, I mean, I think pretty much every fire I'll go reference those data sets and just kind of like take a look at what kind of trends we're seeing. Yeah, I guess that feels like the kind of thing that we rely a little bit less on kind of the community members to point us to. But yeah, certainly for obviously like, you know, anecdotal, like, you know, narrative storytelling for sure.
Yeah. Around his house, and he saw, he's in a nice house, the windows, whatever. He had too high of a reading on the indoor air quality meter, and it's like, what the hell? You know, I thought I was safe in my house. And so he's been doing research on finding out more about all that. So that's a potential source for people, Dan Jaffe, University of Washington. So my question for you guys is, have you heard of anything more behind, besides what the what seems like ineffective advice then from the health department, to, you know, to wear, to have air filters in your house?
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember the name of the research. Aaron Landguth, who I think is in Minnesota maybe, has been doing a lot of work regarding building stock and air quality and fires. And they really are absolutely, you mentioned earlier, the air filters, the air cleaners, whatever you want to call them. That's really, so you want to have a well, and there's really good opportunities for reporting on this, on wildfire smoke, reporting on housing stock, particularly different housing stock between different communities. But the overarching message, I think, from, I think she's an epidemiologist, is the air filters is the way to go. But they're extremely expensive, which is why it's so heartening to hear about these grants to get the air filters into some of the homes. So there's a lot of really good research going in right now, happening right now when it comes to how to keep the pollution outside of your house, and it all comes down to how much money can you spend.
One thing that I just wanted to mention really quickly on that just only sort of related, but I just wanted to mention it, is it something that I was thinking about recently, is that I was thinking about hospitals and air quality specifically around wildfires, and one thing that I just wanted to call out, I was talking to a doctor about this recently, is that hospitals are designed to bring air from outside into inside to kind of, like, prevent, like, the spread of, like, disease. So that poses, like, a pretty interesting, like, challenge, I think, for, like, healthcare systems to mitigate. I just wanted to, like, throw that out there as something to maybe look into.
Yes.
Could you just introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah. I'm a wildfire reporter for North State Public Radio. We're an NPR station in northern rural California. So we're reporting on communities that, you know, our community members are intelligent and they know what's happening to them. They know the risks of smoke and they've seen some of the most hazardous smoke in that area. But also, there are politics involved that I think sometimes minimizes what they think the danger of that smoke is to them. For example, it's hard to tout how important masks are in these scenarios when this is an area where COVID denialism is really rampant and so masks are kind of demonized. That also applies to air filters and that kind of thing. And I just want to know, how would you recommend a local reporter navigate this kind of politics, I guess, while trying to talk about public health?
You want to start?
I mean, I do. It's probably obvious, but they're, you know, I know it's tough to rely on kind of a small group of people, but if there are, like, you know, advocacy organizations or people or a, you know, a small branch of a 350 group, you know, somebody that's there and has the relationships with, I think, the people, you know, this is definitely something in the San Joaquin Valley more than they probably in parts of the San Joaquin Valley that's like, that I know we run into and people run into. So that's what I do, is just trying to get some really real, like, having one-on-ones, you know, like not in response to there's a wildfire now, I want to hear about if you're using masks, but like right now when there's not a wildfire, you know, trying to develop those relationships and one-on-ones really, really helps to build trust with you and at least a few trusted partners in certain parts of the community, because there's definitely... Where what county are you in?
Youth County, but we cover 11 counties.
So. Okay, yeah. It is fun. I mean, probably a lot of you in California know this, as you go from, like, Davis, where, like, everybody looks at you like you're insane if you take off your mask to have a bite of a scone, and then you drive up north, and people are like, what is that on your face? Fast, you know, within about an hour's drive. So, you know, there's definitely people there, and it's just developing those relationships.
Yeah, I think that is such a good question. I don't really have much to add. I just, like, I don't do that much local reporting, so I don't know that I have a great answer for you, honestly. That was really, like, the one time that I've done, like, a lot of local reporting. Yeah, that sounds like a really difficult challenge. I mean, obviously, it's not separate from, you would talk about, like, machismo of, like, you know, like, while, like, firefighters not, you know, wearing, you know, fire protection, things like that, that obviously intersects. That seems really, really challenging. The only thing that I guess I would just add is, I think, like, really focusing on, like, the effects to really vulnerable people in their communities, I think, is maybe likely to be helpful there too.
Yeah. And, yeah, science-based reporting, just talk to the experts and put that above, you know. And if you have somebody, you know, downplaying the risks in your story, just make sure you do the correct thing, which is to immediately say that's, you know, not right. but I, if I could just add one thing. Yes, I said earlier that Erin Landguth is a researcher who's working on the housing stock questions. I just searched my email. She's actually at the University of Montana, so she's a great person to talk to.
Yes, sir.
I'm John Ryan from KUOW Public Radio in Seattle, where we have reportedly several times in the past few fire seasons had the worst air quality of any major city in the world. So this is kind of a data question for Camille, I guess. That if you've seen those rankings of different cities, if I think it's iqair.com, we reported on that, and it's catnip for the audience that is suffering, and like it's something like, yes, I'm not wimpy. This is the worst in the world. But I'm questioning the validity of that assessment if you know anything about that. And the same thing you mentioned, purple air. And I was looking at different stations around our region, and it seemed like purple air, I don't know, it looked like they cooked their books to maybe sell more air filters or something, because they would be a higher, PM 2.5 rating than, if I remember right, the EPA for the same location, same time. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on either of those data sources.
I do. I guess, I just don't really like rankings in general. Like, as a data reporter, like, I think that, like, there's a lot of people really like rankings because it makes things really simple and clear. But I think it's just, it feels really, like, kind of fuzzy to me. But I think that there is a lot of a public appeal and people like rankings. But I guess, like, from the journalistic side, I feel kind of wary about rankings as a metric. I think oftentimes it's more useful just to compare, like, to historical context for a given place and things like that. With purple air, I mean, it's coming from, you're getting, like, an individual measurement from, like, one station, as opposed to like the EPA metrics are kind of like aggregated over like several stations, at least the data set that we were using. So it's definitely not the same thing. I mean, and I think that if you looked at like individual stations, you obviously see more like variance, you know, of like air quality as well. Also with the purple air, sometimes you'll see like, if you just look at it, you'll see like one station that's like way off from everything else. And a lot of the time, I mean, that can just be a faulty metric. Like, it also could be that it's like inside instead of outside or something like that. And like the filtering on their website was just wrong. And it's hard because like on one hand, I think that people should be really like empowered to do their own like air quality monitoring. And I think that people have found, I mean, purple air, people utilize purple air because it's, you know, like up to date. You can see the individual like measurements in your community. You can see how far your house is from like each station. Whereas like, you know, the EPA, you know, dashboard and stuff like that, it's like a lot more, you know, like it's maybe more, more accurate in some ways, but it depends on what kind of, you know, granularity you're looking at. I think that those are like, I guess, like, find data sources for community members. I think it's really difficult to utilize them too much, I guess. I haven't used those data sources in my reporting. I think it's tricky because, like I said, I think there is, like, a lot of, like, reasons why, like, Purple Air is such a valuable resource as a community member, too. I don't know.
Yeah, I spent a couple of years reporting in New Delhi, and I don't pay any attention to the claims that air quality is worse in Seattle today than it is in, you know, there's so many other countries with cities that have such horrific pollution that, yeah, maybe if you find the right spot in a smoke wave, it might be thicker concentration of PM 2.5 than in this part of Beijing or New Delhi. But overall, I don't pay attention to that stuff.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, hi. you know me. I'm Haley Smith. Yeah. I'm a reporter with the LA Times. I wanted to go back to the emissions question that you asked. There was a study, I think, last year that found that smoke from 2020's fires essentially undid years of emissions reduction efforts in California. And I think kind of baked into that was this idea that wildfire smoke should be counted differently than, like, tailpipe emissions or transportation sector emissions. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, whether you think there is a distinction there or whether we should be thinking about wildfire smoke in our larger emissions.
Yeah, so wildfires have always, and I hope will always, occur on the landscape, and it's very difficult to figure out what's the difference between the emissions that would have occurred in this environment 200 years ago to what they are right now. I believe that the EPA federally does not count wildfire smoke events against states when it comes to the Clean Air Act. I think that's probably the correct thing to do. I'm just very skeptical of looking at wildfires and saying that this is a meaningful source of climate change overall. But maybe that's just my perspective, and I could be wrong. But that's kind of how I've always felt about it. I feel like fires are part of the landscape, and these emissions that are going. That I've had my say. And the prescribed burns. you know, unfortunately, a lot of air districts have, are really strict, but they've been changing their policies lately, especially in San Joaquin. You know, they've been more permissive. They're becoming more permissive in a lot of the country of allowing these prescribed burns, even when there's already poor air quality, the rationale being that they want to avoid these huge, huge wildfire events that release these ghastly amounts of smoke.
Tony, I'm just going to add one real quick. I just wary for probably the right reasons, but it's the wrong wariness about like including stuff like wildfire into these like emissions reductions, et cetera, because then it starts driving policy. And you said this then do we just, is our new policy to eliminate all wildfire? And then, you know, how much logging, it just ends up distorting, I think, how we run our policy. So I just get really worried about that.
Yes.
Eliza Barclay, I'm the head of climate op-ed for the New York Times. When we think about Wildfire Smoke as like a major emerging public health issue, I wonder what each of you think would be like the best kind of mass response from the government to protect public health? Like, is it better data and then we just hope that more people stay inside and aren't exposed? Is it air filters for everyone? Is it seal up all the homes? Like, obviously we could do all of these things, but what do you think would be the biggest difference as a response right now?
I mean, I feel like I can't speak with any real expertise on that, to be totally honest. I guess my inclination, honestly, is better home insulation and air filtering is, I guess, just my inclination. I mean, which feels funny to say, I mean, because the other kind of thing that you listed there is data. I mean, I would love to see more data, but to be honest, I don't know that, like, in terms of, you know, overall impact on, like, you know, community health, I don't know that, like, more data that, like, the air quality is, like, quite bad during wildfires is, like, the thing that's going to make the difference. I think that like home insulation is like a real, like very real problem and a real challenge, because even if you've got the air filters running, like if you don't have insulation, like it's, you know, you're just kind of trying to take water out of a boat with buckets, you know, it's like,
I'd agree in my bias a little bit, as I think I said in the beginning, is it's not just wildfire. It's also extreme heat. It's also extreme cold. It's often the same homes and places of work that are the same. So you can also address several of these kind of vulnerabilities by looking at the building stock and looking at the housing stock and trying to get them all next generation.
Which IRA has the potential to do, and we could see a really mass mobilization of efforts to do exactly what these two speakers have just mentioned.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Evan Bush with NBC News, and I'm based in Seattle. And I was just wondering, I think the public tends to think of smoke as smoke, and you've touched a little bit on this, but it does depend to some extent on what's burning. And I was wondering if there are any like real-time data sources that can help us sort of sort out like a very structure-involved fire from, you know, something that's just burning in grassland, or if there's any data that can get us some of the chemicals involved.
I think we're a ways away from that, maybe.
I think my guess is that satellite imagery is probably the thing that would end, or satellite data is going to be the kind of thing to look at for that. That's not something that I think that I've, you know, looked at or done much of, but I think that's a really good question. I know that there's some really interesting, like, companies that are doing, like, kind of private companies that are doing, you know, like, analysis of satellite imagery and also collecting, like, block-level, like, you know, air quality data, which I think is really, really valuable in kind of like sussing out where this is actually coming from. But I don't think that that's, I mean, it's, those are kind of like seasonal averages that they'll kind of put together. And I don't think is quite there yet with looking at like, you know, real time data of kind of what's burning. But I think that's a great question. I'd love to see more of that.
I mean, even with that train crash, it wasn't really clear what was in the air after. So that was a high profile standalone event. So I just, I don't see us getting to a point where we can figure out what's in the smoke on a large-scale basis for quite some time. I think it's true that remote sensing does hold the promise of eventually maybe being able to deliver that information, but, man, it's tough.
I do know that, and granted this is only for California, but the California Air Resources Board, they have different emissions based off of, I believe it's like forest and grasslands, and but I'm not sure exactly how they're modeling whether that's based off of satellite data.
Which wouldn't really pick up if there's something particularly nasty in the fire. Yeah,
exactly.
My name is Olivia Emmer. I'm a freelance journalist.
I'd like to acknowledge that my question is of secondary importance to the impacts of smoke on vulnerable communities. I live in a community and report locally quite a lot. We're a recreation-based economy, and I'm curious if there's any data or people looking at changes in human behavior to avoid smoke. So are people who would normally come to our community to fly fish, raft, mountain bike, etc., how are they changing their behavior en masse around the country?
That's a good one. That's a really good topic, and it is a big deal, and I'm not aware of, I would say talk to whoever has a stake in local tourism economy, whether it's a tourism bureau or a chamber of commerce. They're the ones that are most likely to be able to have some sort of assessment. I have not seen anything that really rigorous scientifically that quantifies this, but you're onto a really good topic. That's a very important topic, and if you want to email me or whatever after this, I can share whatever I've learned over recent years. That, you know, Protect Our Winters might even have something, might have suggestions for who you can talk to. But yeah, that's a really, really important topic.
Yeah, I don't really think that there's like much collection of like demographics, I think, generally, like who's visiting when. Yeah, that's such a great question, but I don't know like specifically. I think maybe there is, you know, depending on like, you know, where you're looking at. Speaking of Protect Our Winters, I tried to look at a story of the demographics of like who skis, and it's just no one really collects that kind of thing. But I think that's such a great question. So,
actually, the skiing industry has the data. I know they have it, but they won't let us have it. It's
Protect Our Winters. You and me,
No. It's an industry association representing the ski fields, but although they represent all ski fields, they tend to really represent the big players who are kind of benefiting from climate change, and they have data. I had somebody go to a library in Boulder to try to pull the data that we know that they have, but they won't share, but it was only fragments of it. Yeah, it's...
Hi, my name is
Peter
Tilbury. I'm an environmental justice fellow at GRIS, and I have a question for Phoebe, which is about the reporting system of, you know, dangerous air quality for farm workers and outdoor workers. You said that, or you mentioned earlier that was kind of a bit of a problem. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, you know, protecting farm workers when they're exposed to wildfires.
Sure. I mean, I think there's data issues. There's kind of the whole issue of at certain thresholds, different rules apply, but at no point are workers, you know, paid for situations in which, you know, close to 1,000 AQI, there's just no protections. And I mean, I think that it seems like our policy suggestion would be that something like, you know, crop insurance or some kind of, there's wage insurance for situations in which it's like 120 degrees, for example, or the AQI is at a level that people can't work, or that there's, you know, rains or flooding taking people out of the field. So I think that we're like, we'd like to disassociate making ends meet with putting kind of your life and lungs at risk. And that at this point has not gotten, I don't know if the word is traction, but unless you can find, it has to be public, I guess it has to be publicly paid, because that kind of cost, the agricultural industry is not going to bear that kind of cost.
I do want to say, so have you all seen a lot of non-compliance with like those thresholds where folks are not supposed to be working? Have you seen a lot of like, do and employers generally, you know, abide by that, or have you all seen?
Well, a lot of it is around masking, so no. So there's a lot of people, like even at this 500, that threshold of 500 where you can't be working without a mask, people aren't masking. There are different, you know, in it, like admittedly, some people that we work with cannot generate the, especially if they're working piece rate, which means you get paid by the piece, they can't generate the amount of money that they need. If they're wearing a mask, they feel, especially within 95. So there is some of that, but then there's also, there's just like little things which seem probably little to us, aren't little things, that if you need to walk across the land, the kind of the field to get a mask, if it is being provided, then you're not paid for that work, that, you know, 20 minutes or 15 minutes. So that, you're, you know, that's taken out. So I think there's a kind of like a broad from A, masks aren't even being provided, people aren't being notified of the air quality, to it's sort of, there's so much pressure. There's probably also, like, you know, probably some machismo, but there's also just so much pressure from the employer and from the need to make wages to not take the time and take those steps.
If I could just say one other thing on the data front, like, I think that's, yeah, really difficult to kind of get comprehensive data, right, on, like, farm workers' exposure or any kind of specific community's exposure. And I guess just, like, one thing I would say about that, as well as just, like, data on this more broadly, is that, like, I read an interesting study recently about some researchers who attached, like, sensors to people with asthma and actually, like, measured their exposure over, like, a several weeks period. And those sensors are, like, commercially available. Like, one thing that I've wanted to do for a while that we, like, haven't done, and I think that there's, like, a lot of potential to do more of, is just collect your own data on this. Like, not every newsroom has the capacity to do this, but, like, if you can buy a bunch of sensors and, like, partner with some, like, farm workers, like, you know, you can just like, see what their exposure is, like, see how that compares to, like, you know, the EPA's measurements, see how that compares to all these other kind of, like, official measurements, and I think that could be really interesting.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Jonathan Hale. I'm a freelance photographer and journalist in the Bay Area. And I was wondering, as wildfires continue to impact people's lives on a personal level, how do you go about portraying the humanistic side of the impacts of wildfires and doing so sensitively and respectfully?
It's like any other trauma reporting, you know. It's the Dart Center for Trauma Reporting, I think, would be a good resource for this. How do you talk to, I was going to say victims of disasters, the alternative language is survivors of wildfires. There's a lot of advice around that and how to do it sensitively. I know I personally don't push anybody to talk about anything they're uncomfortable with. I let them take their time. I am very clear about what a journalist does, what I'm doing there, why I'm there. You know, you let them talk more than you're interjecting with questions. They'll ramble with anecdotes, and then they'll say something about the cat died, and it's very difficult to do it sensitively, but I would really urge you to look into some of the resources available from the Dart Center for Trauma Reporting or whatever it's called.
Yeah, I was talking to a colleague who had reported on a recent mass shooting kind of about this general area, just since I don't do that kind of those kind of interviews very often. So it's something that I have some kind of like apprehension around when I do have to do it, just because I think I'm a little like less used to navigating those types of interviews. And I guess like the advice that you know she gave me just when we were talking about this was just like the basic principle of like, you know, do no harm. Just like this person's already having like a really bad day. Like you can't make this better, just like don't make it worse. And just kind of like, yeah, kind of open up the space to speak and listen, and you know, don't be afraid to express like empathy, because you know we're all human. So
and if they're talking to you voluntarily, of course you're not pressuring them. You know, you can feel a little bit extractive doing these types of interviews, but at the same time you're giving them an opportunity to talk about something that's very important to them. So don't shy away from doing it.
We have time for one more.
I'm interested about liability, both from like in power line ignitions in California is a significant percentage of the fires. Is there liability potential? Have you seen any cases from smoke impacts on people from the ignition source of those fires? And then similarly, I heard a comment from one of you that sort of touched on the crop insurance part. I understand that crop insurance is not available for if smoke makes it so that, you know, the fruit can't be picked. Right, and so then you have this sort of more long-term impact, right? It's important to protect the workers, like we're doing in Oregon, from the smoke impact. But then the farm might go under because they can't pick one season, and crop insurance doesn't cover that. It only covers for damage, not for ceasing operations. So just kind of those liability aspects that I think are a big, big part of it.
Yeah, you know, the conversation around liability for climate change impacts and so forth, and I have not seen anybody bringing cases against PG&E. I could be wrong for health impacts. I've not seen anything like that.
I haven't.
I will say that there is a pretty good agricultural economist over at UC Davis. Just given, I mean, in California, with the Central Valley being one of the most productive agricultural regions in the world, I believe that he would be probably a good resource, and I'm looking for other folks in other communities who could probably weigh in. I believe his name is Aaron Smith over at UC Davis, who is really good at like looking at what the impacts of natural disasters and other things like that have been on, the prices of different foods and the availability. So, gotcha. Well, I really appreciate you all for turning out. We'll be here if you all want to, introduce yourselves. But thank you so much.